Tonight, on This Is Vinyl Tap. "It lies with me," cried the Queen of Maybe. "There's always been Ethel." Bob the Knob came out on his job. "It's 1 o'clock and time for lunch. Bum de bum de bum."
Over the garden wall, two little lovers, cuckoo to you. Keep them going, great shot. I know what I like, and I like what I know. Getting better.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
All right, it's not tonight. It's morning. And this is the Vinegaroon Dog Clinic and Saloon. We're going to have assorted animal sounds this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, it's still morning. It's almost 11. That means college football will be starting in about 5 minutes, and we're sacrificing all those games to be here with you today and to talk about a band called Genesis to Revelations. Wait, I'm sorry. That's the old name?
Yeah.
That's the one that gets you put in the religious music section of the... And does it inspire? Yeah. So you got to get rid of Revelations, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
It's the band called Genesis, and this is Selling England by the Pound. Tony, are we selling England by weight or by currency?
I actually think it's probably both.
Yeah. So you think it's both?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, the theme of the album, we'll get into that a little bit more, is about the commercialization of Great Britain, specifically England, and kind of the selling out of the old ways for the new ways, and the pound being the currency makes sense, but also just chipping away at it by selling it by the weight as well. Yeah. I don't know. It seems to make sense that it's both to me.
I mean, there's all sorts of references to commercial entities in England throughout this album. That's one of the things I learned about, which I didn't really get, because some of the songs sound so old, like they almost sound medieval in places.
Well, I think that's part of the charm of this, and Gabriel even said he was trying to combine that sort of old English folk elements with the newer sort of things, and part of that juxtaposition, I think, is what the band was going for.
Isn't that a little bit of a theme in prog music?
You mean bringing in those old sort of folky elements and stuff? There's a lot of, your
mythology and
the especially the British bands with the whole sort of medieval thing going on.
Yeah. That brings me to something I feel that it's important for us to talk about before we go further.
Mm-hmm.
I have agreed to a contract without y'all's permission.
Okay.
And, I hope it's okay. We have been contracted. This is Vinyl Tap Incorporated. LLC has been commissioned to name the bands that will appear on Prog Mountain. Which will be carved out of the Davis Mountains in West Texas with the great prog bands of all time. So, knowing that we had one of the world's most enthusiastic proglodytes, I thought that
proglodytes.
We should.
If that doesn't catch on, it should. That's awesome.
I wanted to do something here. I wanted to ask Tony. for a name, and then I'm going to ask Jonathan JM for a name, and then I'm going to skip myself.
Why?
Because I don't care what I think about this. Okay. That's how much
I'm... How many bands are we picking?
You get one each time.
No, but I mean, how many bands in total are we picking?
It's Mount Rushmore.
So four.
Four.
We can cheat and do five.
Okay.
Okay. Hmm. Tony?
Yeah.
Who should be on Mount Progmore?
Well, I think definitely Genesis, and this Gabriel era Genesis. And I just want to say this up front about this band. When I'm listening to this band, the Gabriel era Genesis, it may be my favorite band at that moment. I mean, it sounds weird, but I when I put them on, there's nothing I want to listen to more. That sounds weird too, but I love this band so much. I don't think about them enough, but when I put them on, I was like, oh my God, this band's great. So yeah, this era of Genesis definitely belongs on
Mount Progmore.
Mount Progmore.
Jonathan J.M. Rowe?
King Crimson. I think that they, you know, they probably don't have some of the element, like we were talking about the medieval elements and kind of the you know, the fairyland stuff, even though they have Lark's Tongue and Aspic and that more like the Merlin side of Prague rather than the dwarf side of Prague. I think King Crimson's definitely got to be up there.
Okay, then we'll go to me. Pass. Tony?
You know who I'm going to say next.
I do.
Rush.
Bum, bum, bum.
Really?
That's a surprise. Yeah. Yeah, because that mid-70s to late 70s period Rush, especially like Hemispheres, Feral to Kings, yeah. That they deserve to be on Mount Progmore for that stuff, definitely.
Okay.
All right. Jonathan J.M. Rowe?
I'm going to go with one that is it's a recent addition for me. If you'd asked me a year ago, I'd say Gentle Giant.
Ah!
They're one of the more interesting prog bands.
I think they fall in line with Genesis as well. They're one of those bands that people who don't like prog like them for some reason. I'm not sure why.
And I'm one of those.
That's interesting. I've noticed that too. We'll go back to our main prognosticator. T?
Yeah. I get to pick another one?
One more for you. One more for John.
You got to say yes.
Yeah.
Is that who you're going to pick?
That's what I was going to pick.
But how do you not say yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you got
to
say yes.
No to yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. We already made enough of those jokes on the last podcast regarding tomorrow.
I'm happy to toss yes to you if you want to take them, and I'll pick somebody else.
Why don't you? I'll take yes, and you take somebody else.
I'm going to pick Tull, Jethro Tull.
Okay.
All
right. Well,
I mean, you got to pick a band who's got an album where the entire album is one song. I mean, come on.
Yeah. It can have Roman numerals.
Yeah. But I mean, Thick as a Brick is one song.
That's pretty prog. That's a Progosian activity.
Yeah. I mean, there's bands we've skipped. Like, would you put Kansas in there?
I mean, there's lots of prog bands that are just kind of
but
bubbling
not
on
every
the
there's a lot of presidents.
Yeah, they're bubbling on the surface.
They don't get to be on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
We have to narrow it to a few.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Who's the best African American prog band? I wish this was a video right now. Tony's gone completely blank.
I can't think of one.
That was a joke.
Parliament might have some prog elements to it. Parliament Funkadelic, but
there's a band out of the UK around this time. I can't remember the name of them now. It's not going to be any good. But I saw them at a record store, and I went back the album was intriguing. So I went back and listened to it, and it had prog elements too. But I can't remember the name of it. But it's an all black band. But they're more fusion. Mm-hmm. Fusion and prog. I mean, there's some overlapping in that jazz fusion stuff. And
well, that happens here. Some of these guys were playing with jazz at the time this record was made.
I mean, would you put Pink Floyd in that? In the prog? I mean, certainly they've done whole sides.
Yeah. But they're not. I think it's worth talking about Pink Floyd and Genesis because I think there's a lot of similarities between them in this regard. Genesis and Pink Floyd both have extremely talented musicians that aren't showy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always a group effort when they're putting their music together. I think Tony Banks said, he's the keyboardist for Genesis, for those of you who don't know, said that that what Genesis always strove for is this idea that technique is a tool. It's not an end to itself. And a lot of these prog bands, technique was an end to itself. You get people like ELP, Emerson, Lincoln Palmer, where you got Keith Emerson throwing knives at a keyboard. Yeah. Or even Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, when you get Tales from Topographic Oceans, I think it's a double album where there's just each band member got a single side to do what they wanted to do.
Like the guy from Mad TV. Look what I can do. Look what I can do. No one remembers that?
No.
That show that was like Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, I remember Mad TV.
I don't remember that guy.
I don't remember that guy.
I remember that character.
Oh, he was so funny.
But yeah, that's Genesis doesn't have that element to them, and neither did Floyd. I also think Genesis, it's worth comparing them to just because I don't think most progressive rock bands have a lead singer that you would focus on and go, God, that guy's got a great voice. Genesis is one of them. I think Jethro Tull is another band like that.
I'll give you that.
The big distinction between the two is that as much as I love Ian Anderson's voice, he doesn't have anywhere near the soul that Peter Gabriel has.
I'll give you that too.
I think they're both remarkable.
They are.
I could listen to both of them sing.
I agree. But
they also have something else in common.
What's that?
They play the
flute.
They do play the flute. I was about to ask who's the best flautist.
Well,
but I don't think
Ian Anderson's more interesting of the two. But I think probably technique wise, Gabriel actually knows what he's doing. Ian Anderson would admit he self taught. He didn't know what he's doing on the flute.
And I didn't have to be convinced on that. The thing I think they have in common is a lot of times I wish they would drop everything in the mix except for their voices. When Peter Gabriel sings by himself on this album, it's the best part of the album. So,
well, it's
at the beginning, like when he's just solo. Yeah.
There's a word for that. It's acapuco.
it's difficult not to just love his voice. I mean, that's what got them their initial record deal was, the guy was Jonathan King. It wasn't the songs. It was hearing Peter Gabriel sing. He's like, I can do something with this, you know?
Yeah.
But, well, I said when we did his album, I think it's hard to judge his songwriting because his songs sound so good when he sings them.
Yeah. That's worth also mentioning when you said when we did his album, because this is Gabriel's the first artist we've talked about three different times.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this podcast that we did the Gabriel podcast, we did the
what was that albums that we liked that were not
underrated,
underappreciated albums,
and then this one. So
so he's a very talented person.
Mm-hmm. I think he's up there in terms of people we've talked about now with Little Steven and
Todd Rundgren.
Todd Rundgren is also on there. I was thinking of Nick Lowe.
Oh yeah, pops up all the time.
Yeah.
The and Dave Mason keeps popping up.
Yeah,
I want to talk about Genesis and Gabriel. I'm not a big Genesis fan. I'm not a big prog fan. I don't think I'd listen to any prog if it were not for this podcast.
sorry.
No, that's not bad. It's good to get knocked out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
But to me, there's two Genesises. Is it Genesis?
Genesee.
Two beginnings. And I think for most people my age, the Genesis they think of is Phil Collins. And that's I call it the pop Genesis. I call it, if you go to a roller skating party, like JM had a roller skating party for his birthday in January, and we all went. And if you'll remember, they did play Phil Collins Genesis at that rink. And I think that's the one you'd hear. I don't think you'd ever hear this one at the, Tony, don't look worried. I'm making that up. He didn't have a party, and you would have been invited if he did.
And I didn't like Genesis back then.
The, But you know
what
I'm trying
to remember. I wasn't upset. I was like, did he have a roller skating party? Why didn't I know about that?
Actually, it's been a long time since I've been to a roller skating party. Yeah. But there's the Genesis that was extremely popular.
Yeah,
and it was extremely poppy. And had the song with the drum solo that everybody goes, this is the most awesome drum solo in the world. It's about a guy that drowned.
Oh,
it's
that's so his deep. Solo. Yeah.
What is it? It's a solo
something,
album?
Something in the air.
Oh, something in the air.
So I'm not even talking about Genesis anymore.
Yeah. But, it's kind of hard to, they kind of meld to me because he was putting out solo albums that sounded just like Genesis albums to me. But
and this, we're talking about really different bands, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, sound wise, not core membership wise.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, and they were, and Gabriel's even said this when he left, there was some speculation that the band would be no more, and he's like, I don't know what they're worried about, I knew they'd be fine, and of course, they're significantly more successful after I left, so.
Yeah.
So it was Gabriel and Steve Hackett that left that allowed Phil Collins just to take over and make it into something.
You know what's surprising is that he didn't take over as much as I thought he did. Even though he did the vocalist, you know, a lot of the vocals and stuff. But if you look at the songwriting credits, even the lyrics, he didn't write some of their bigger hits.
Tony Banks and Mike Rutherford have always been the kind of the driving force behind this band. Even at in this era, they were kind of the controlling guys, if you will, behind the scenes and stuff. I mean, coming into this band without doing any, you know, just being a fan, you always assumed, I think it's the thing most people think, oh, it's a lead singer, he's writing lyrics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A vast majority of the stuff written at this time when Gabriel was lead singer was written by Mike Rutherford or Tony Banks.
Yeah, that surprised me when I saw that. I guess Peter Gabriel's writing mostly was around the lyrics.
Which
are very time consuming. This album requires a lot of research into lyrics because there's so many.
There's a lot of depth to them.
And there's references that we're not familiar with because this is Texas.
Well, and you got to remember, Gabriel, Banks, and Rutherford all went to a public school in England, which is a private school anywhere else. And they were a very, very, very well educated guys. And so they didn't think twice about littering their songs with references that they were familiar with.
Yeah.
To hell with anybody else not knowing what they were talking about.
Well, since you brought up their schooling, you want to start going through some Genesis history.
Well,
we've been through a little bit before.
Not to tell you what to do as a host, I know it's very early, but we didn't ask the question we always ask.
Oh.
I'm just curious if you're going to ask that or not.
You know, that's true. Jam?
Yes?
Why did Tony pick this album?
As opposed to the other Genesis albums? You know, Tony, I don't know.
Maybe we should ask Tony.
Yeah. I was actually trying to guess why Tony picked this one as opposed to Foxtrot or Lion Lies Down on
Rome. Well, I'm not comfortable enough yet, or maybe at all, to talk about a double album. I know we've talked about one that really it shouldn't have been a double album, but
you talking about Clash?
No. Oh, we did talk about Clash.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I was talking about Layla.
Yeah.
But the Clash has enough songs on it to merit a double album.
It has to be a double album, and it's one of the few double albums in the world that pays off. You're talking about London Calling.
Yeah.
The problem is, for this format, we already have enough trouble getting through 12 songs.
Right.
So that would take Lamb Lies Down on Broadway off the list.
Yeah. And that really, if you distill some of the little bits and musical bits from that album, it probably doesn't need to be a double album. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, there's not really a bad song on it, but regardless of that, my favorite album by them, we already talked about on the Underappreciated podcast, which was Nursery Crime. I love Nursery Crime. And in particular, I love the song, The Musical Box. But I think the reason why I picked this album is because it's the most accessible album of the Gabriel era, I think.
You think so?
Yes. I also think the themes of it are a lot more accessible and modern than any of the other stuff they talk about. And I think it is quite possibly the best distillation of what they were doing on one album. I mean, a lot of people think it's their crowning achievement. This is a well-regarded album by Genesis fans, not necessarily by the band, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, it is.
But well, when in my research, this is the one that Genesis fans held in the highest esteem.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the album people talk about. There's a maturing of it. Again, it's not my favorite, but I get all of the reasons why people like this album a lot. And so I thought, you know, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm thinking about picking an album, sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes I think, okay, what's a good album that's going to actually interest you guys and get you guys involved and not be too out there? That's another reason I picked this. I think this is the least out there album of the Gabriel era as well. I mean, there's no stories. There's no songs about somebody getting their head knocked off by a croquet mallet. You know, there's no songs.
Showing up in the middle of Broadway.
Yeah, there's no songs about giant hogweeds taking over the, or there's, you know.
Well, this was not their first album, Tony.
No, it was their
fifth album.
Fifth album.
Yeah.
If you count from Genesis to Revelation, which you should.
Have we talked about a band that got his earliest start?
I don't think so.
Tell us about the start, because I find it really interesting how young these guys are.
Yeah, so you can't really talk about the Genesis story without talking about the Charterhouse School, which is where the four main guys early on met. Like I said earlier, it's a public school, which in England is a private school. It's where moneyed people sent their kids. And they met in the 60s. They were all attending school in the mid 60s. And they sort of started off with two distinct groups of songwriters, Tony Banks and Peter Gabriel, and then Mike Rutherford and a guy named Anthony Phillips, who was their original guitarist. I'm going to just talk briefly about each of those guys. I'm trying not to bore you guys because we've talked about Gabriel a lot in other podcasts. But just briefly, one of the things that he was a drummer, we talked about that.
And yeah, he was the original drummer for Genesis, wasn't he?
No.
Oh, he wasn't.
No, but he started off as a drummer. He's also, Gabriel we're talking about. He was also, a big R&B guy, big soul guy and rhythm and blues guy. And he was also, influenced by church music. In fact, he found singing hymns really a powerful emotional experience. And there's a quote where he puts it. He says, of the few good hymns, which are anthem-like in some ways, I always think it's the closest thing that the white man gets to soul music.
Well, it is soul music.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. He takes piano lessons at age 9. He starts attending the Charterhouse School in 63. And he talks about Otis Redding being his hero. I think he actually saw him live at one point and it blew the top of his head off. Call me Mr. Pitiful. That's my name now. Oh, call me Mr. Pitiful. That's how I got my fame. But people just don't understand. He's also plays drums in a soul and jazz band at school. Like I said, he and Tony Banks are kind of the two that hook up. Tony Banks is the youngest of five kids. He's sent to boarding school early on at age 7. His mother, Tony Banks' mother, was a pianist, and she arranges the headmaster's wife at the boarding school he's at 7 to give him lessons. So he starts taking piano lessons at that age. So by the time he gets to Charterhouse, which is the same year Gabriel joins that school, he's already a pretty darn good piano player. He continues to take piano as an extracurricular subject at Charterhouse. Mike Rutherford comes to the school a little bit later, but he, like Tony Banks, is also at boarding school from age 7. He's also learning to play guitar at that age, and he's exposed to his sister's record collection, which is Elvis, Everly Brothers, Cliff Richard. You know, he gets all that kind of stew of early rock and roll. Yeah. And he enters charter school in 1964, right before his 14th birthday. And then the last person we want to talk about in terms of the charter school era Genesis is this guy named Anthony Phillips, who, like I said, was their original guitarist. He started playing guitar also from an early age. And by the time he got to the Charterhouse School, he was an accomplished guitarist. Anthony Phillips and starts a band when he gets to the school called The Anon, and they need a rhythm guitarist, so he taps Rutherford to join on rhythm guitar. And Rutherford actually is their lead singer for a while because their original lead singer left because of his parents. It's funny. All these kids at the school were getting pressure from parents and the school who thought rock and roll was the most evil thing on the planet. And they didn't want their kids, their sons, playing this music because it was going to send them down the road of drugs and women and all sorts of stuff.
Like that Johnny Cash guy.
Yes, exactly.
They got letters from their parents like Chris.
I mean, the Charterhouse guys really thought that these kids, they join a rock and roll band, the next thing, next step is to start taking down the establishment. You know, it was really subversive stuff.
And then we have a reactionary album here tonight, which is kind of ironic.
Yes, exactly. Gabriel and Banks also get together, and they start messing around, writing songs and stuff. They actually played. So you've got Rutherford and Phillips as the Anon, and Gabriel and Tony Banks played as a band. I think they did one gig as a band called The Garden Wall. And the drummer for that band was a guy named Chris Stewart. So the way they get together is Anthony Phillips, who's, according to all the guys, had the real drive in the early parts of the band, wants to make a tape that would feature songs that were composed by him and Rutherford, and they could maybe get it in the right hands. So they ask Banks, Tony Banks, to come in and fill out the sound. He invites Peter Gabriel along because they're, you know, buddies. Mm-hmm. And they record this tape at a friend's house. Gabriel couldn't make the first session, so Anthony Phillips sang, and Tony Banks says, you know what, I think we might want to wait for Peter to show up. I think you might find it a little bit better if he's singing on some of these songs. And so he does to supply the vocals, and Chris Stewart's added as a drummer. This is around 67 or 68. They end up getting this tape into the hands of this guy named Jonathan King, who was an ex-Charterhouse pupil. They tell a story about how none of them were brave enough to do it.
Yeah.
So they get a friend to toss the tape into Jonathan King's MG. I guess he's visiting the school one day, so they get the tape into his hands.
He was kind of royalty at the Charterhouse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He had a hit with this song called Everyone's Gone to the Moon. He was a producer and a musician. So they were thinking they'd get this in his hands and maybe he could do something, which he did. He liked Gabriel's voice a lot. Wasn't necessarily thrilled with the music, but he ends up getting him signed to Decca, and he's going to produce their first album. He gets them not a great contract. It's one of these 5-year, five album deals that kind of ties their hands. Luckily, because of their age, it gets renegotiated to a 1-year, one album deal. And so they start working on songs. They bring songs back to him, and he's like, I'm not real fond of this stuff. And so Gabriel and Banks knew that he liked the Bee Gees. So they're like, you know what? We're going to write a song that sounds like the Bee Gees. So they composed a song called The Silent Sun.
Before I play that, we need to explain that there was a Bee Gees before Disco. Saturday Night Fever. Yeah. That how would you describe them? They were
Beatlesque pop.
Yeah, they were.
And they wrote some fantastic songs. Yes, very lush, orchestral.
They put some very good albums out, mm-hmm. and people who don't like disco would like these albums.
Yeah, I'm one of those people.
Yeah, they wrote a lot of songs for other people as well, too, that weren't discos.
Oh, yeah. No, I was saying to Doug earlier, I've got a collection of stuff that they wrote that done by a bunch of Australian artists, written for those artists, and it's fantastic. But anyway, so yeah, they wrote this song called The Silent Sun in a Bee Gees-esque manner.
The silent sun that never shines. She is the warmth of my lonely heart. The motion of a turning wheel. Can't you stop it and look around? Baby, you feel so close. I wish you could.
If that doesn't, you told me that was the Bee Gees.
If I told you it was Genesis and Peter Gabriel singing, would you believe that?
It doesn't sound like him.
So King loves it. They released it as their first single in 68 under the name Genesis. It's a name that King came up with. Actually, they were originally called From Genesis to Revelation, and then they shortened it to Genesis, although they use that title for their debut album. And it gets some airplay. In fact, Rutherford remembers sitting in Anthony Phillips' kitchen and hearing it for the first time. They're like, oh, we're going to make it. We're going to be on top of the pops. In fact, they went to Carnaby Street and bought a bunch of new clothes to be on because they just knew it was going to happen. And then it didn't happen. They had a bunch of new clothes and no appearance on Top of the Pops. Mm-hmm. Due to pressure from his parents, Chris Stewart, the drummer, ends up, he was still actually at the chart. He was still in school. Yeah, the rest of them weren't. He ends up getting boot or leave because of that. And he's replaced by this guy named John Silver. King goes on to produce their first album, like I said, which is named From Genesis to Revelations. And it's based on this loose concept he came up with, which is kind of this biblical story of man. And it is a loose concept. They reworked some of the lyrics of songs they'd already written. They renamed some of the titles of them to fit that concept. And we talked about this earlier in an earlier podcast. When it's released, it's placed in a lot of religious sections in record stores.
Yeah.
And subsequently sells around 400 copies.
So that doesn't make rock and roll fans look for it there.
No.
And
no.
The religious people who find it are not going to be pleased with it.
They'd be a little surprised. They released a second single called A Winter's Tale. That also flops. And so Gabriel tells this great story. He's like, so our parents start suggesting some plan Bs. They're thinking we need a couple of plan Bs.
Yeah.
So what happens is Tony Banks gets up attending university. The drummer goes off to the States and starts going to school at Cornell. So they're kind of in limbo, but the rest of the band minus the drummer, there's like, we need to continue this. So Banks is allowed to take a year off. And he's like, let's do this for a year and we'll reassess things after a while. They get this new drummer named John Mayhew, through an ad in Melody Maker, and they start gigging around. But because the album and the singles don't do well, and also because they're starting to explore non-Bee Gees related stuff, King drops them. He's like, I don't want to deal with this. This isn't what I signed up for. So they go their separate ways. And so they start this new direction. And what is that? Well, it's these more complex songs like we're going to be talking about tonight. They talk about this band called Family as a big influence. They also talk about Procol Harum, which we've talked about before. Procol Harum, when that first Procol Harum album came out in Whiter Shade of Pale, that sort of like changed British music.
Yeah.
This is the summer of love, 67, 68, when this stuff's happening. They also talk about the Nice, the band The Nice. You guys know who was in The Nice?
Keith Emerson.
Keith Emerson. Yep. But Gabriel routinely says in interviews, you guys don't, if you think The Nice is ELP, you're wrong. That, or he actually calls them ELP, which I think is pretty funny. he's like, that was a hip band. So they're playing these soft acoustic numbers that usually have a couple of 12 strings involved that build to these big climaxes. This is something that is going to be a trademark of their sound going forward. And they start gaining a reputation and a following. In March of 70, they end up getting a 6-week residency at a club in Soho. This guy named John Anthony from Charisma Records sees him one night and he's blown away. So he brings the founder of the label, Tony Stratton Smith, down the next week. He is also excited by what he sees, and he convinces them to sign with the label. He also signs him with a management deal, and he was managing The Nice as well. So that helped their decision. And they start working on this album, Trespass, which is their second album, but really their first one to kind of sound like Genesis. And they get John Anthony, the guy who saw them and convinces the Charisma founder to sign them. He's the one who produces this album. The cover artwork, and I mentioned this because this guy does the cover for the next three albums, including Trespasses, by this guy named Paul Whitehead. And the songs are a mile away from their debut. And it really reflects this kind of new, complex, sophisticated sound they're going for. Like I said, lots of layered 12 strings. Gabriel's vocals are significantly more confident and soulful.
Trying to find a needle in a haystack. Chilly wind, you're piercing like a dagger in her true soul. Hey, nobody needs to discover me.
So it sells 6,000 copies on its initial release. There is a song called The Knife on there that was released as a single. The album, oddly enough, hits number one in Belgium, which they start actually touring in Europe because of that. But after that album, as kind of the history of this band, trouble is a brewing. Anthony Phillips doesn't like this direction much. He hated playing live. He actually, I think, had stage fright.
Yeah, stage. That was probably the deciding. The interview I saw with him was that he was just terrified of going on stage eventually.
And he also said there were too many cooks in the kitchen. It was tough to get their ideas across. So he leaves the band. Around the same time, they're a little fed up with this their drummer at the time, Mayhew, and so they kick him out of the band. And so now they're looking for, the three of them, Peter Gabriel, Tony Banks, and Mike Rutherford, are looking for a drummer and a guitarist. And they place an anonymous ad in Melody Maker that states, Tony Stratton Smith is looking for a 12-string guitarist who can also play lead, plus drummer sensitive to acoustic music. And one of these ads catches the attention of a gentleman by the name of Phil Collins.
Yeah.
Well, Phil Collins had been in a band called The Flaming Youth with this guy named John Walker, keyboardist Brian Chatton, bassist Gordon Flash Smith, and a guitarist named Ronnie Carl. They actually released an album called Arc 2 in 1969 in the UK, and it was a flop. And because of that, they didn't gig around much. Collins is looking for a new band. And so he calls up Peter Gabriel to ask about auditioning. And at the time, Phil Collins says, oh, yeah, by the way, I played with George Harrison. And Peter Gabriel is like stunned by this. He's like, oh, this is great. Anyway, later on, after Phil Collins tries out, they learn that the only thing he did was play tambourine on the session. He didn't actually play drums. But he brings along to the audition Flaming Youth guitarist Carl with him to try out. They arrive early, so Phil Collins is able to hear all the other drummers playing. And so by the time he gets up there, he knows exactly what they want, and he nails it. Nails it perfectly. He's 19 at the time.
Yeah.
He was so a child. How old are they?
Star.
18. 17, 18, 19.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's nuts. They're all under 20 years old.
Well, he was a child actor.
Yeah, what was he in?
I think he was in Oliver. He was in a production of Oliver, and I think I think when they transferred it to being a movie, he didn't get to be as big a part, but he was actually.
Is he in the movie?
I think he's in the movie as one of the background guys.
Oh, we'll have to find that. Yeah. Put that on the website.
Well, he was in Tommy.
Phil Collins was.
I think
the live version.
Yeah,
he played the nasty uncle.
Oh, really?
Fiddle about.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
And he was very convincing.
Going back to the story, the guitarist Carl did not pass the audition. He does play with them on one gig because they're still looking for a guitarist, but they need one. So he plays with them in Aylesbury just before Steve Hackett joins. The band starts rehearsing what would be their next album, Nursery Crime, without a lead guitarist. And that's where Steve Hackett enters the picture. He's born in 1950, the day before Peter Gabriel, which is interesting.
That is it.
He takes to music at a very young age. The first thing he picks up is a harmonica at age 3 and starts playing the harmonica because his dad could play one. And his dad had also been a bugler in the army, and he played guitar. And music was really around their household a lot. He found his way through Genesis because he placed an ad in a music rag that said, imagine if guitarist/writer seeks involvement with receptive musicians determined to drive beyond existing stagnant music forms. That's what his ad said. And Gabriel saw it and was intrigued. So he phoned him up, invited him to come to a free show they were playing, told him to listen to Trespass. Hackett was impressed enough that he tried out afterwards, and he was in. So they all are working on this album, Nursery Crime, which, as I said, is my favorite album of theirs. It was on that podcast for Underappreciated Picks. They're recording at Trident Studios in 71. Again, John Anthony is the producer. Again, Paul Whitefield. What's weird about this band was he's not on the Trespass album, but there's a guitar tone on that album that carries through all this Hackett era Genesis. What is that? It's a very Genesis sounding tone. There's not another band that sounds that way.
Yeah, I almost think Robert Fripp kind of has that sound too. But it's like the term that I've heard used is Wimburst, and I'm not sure if that's an effect, but it's some sort of it keeps the
Wimburst makes me think of something else.
Oh, yes. Nothing like intestinal gas humor this early in the morning.
The style is you overload the pickups, so it sounds, it's got a distortion to it, but it keeps the tone going, or it keeps you hit a note and the note will just ring forever. And
yeah.
It stays at that same volume.
Okay.
And this is a shortened edition of Is It Just Me?
Yeah.
Do prog bands like Gibsons more than Fenders?
I think that's very much me. Yeah.
Okay.
And he is really into the Les Paul.
Well, this band, though, has a lot of Rickenbackers all
there
over
the place.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. Mike Rutherford plays a lot of Rickenbackers. Oh, there's 12
strings. He's got a double neck that he plays, and then there's 12 strings everywhere.
Yeah.
Just a brief aside before we continue the history. I think it's worth talking about, because when we were talking earlier about what a group effort this is, every person in this band is amazingly talented musician.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Collins is an incredible drummer.
There's songs on this,
yeah,
where or parts on this album where you can just tell he's
amazing.
He's amazing.
It's Steve Hackett. You already talked about his great guitarist. Tony Banks, a fabulous keyboard player. And there's a song on here that really showcases that.
Yeah.
And Rutherford, who plays the 12 string, he's a good guitarist, but he's also the bass on this album is also very, very good as well. So it goes out without saying about Gabriel's vocals and
his flute playing. Yeah. He before he was doing a lot of this stuff, he played on a Cat Stevens album.
He did.
Doobie-doobie-doobie-doo. Oh, yeah. The past is the future. The future is now. And now is
tomorrow.
Something.
Yeah. Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Making sense is overrated.
All right. As you know, that means it's time for a connection or connections. This is where we connect this album and artist to previous podcasts on this great podcast. Does anyone have a connection?
I have one. Engineer on this was a guy named Rhett Davies, and he was the engineer on Avalon by Roxy Music. Hmm. And I think he was, he works with Brian Eno a lot. So,
He got Brian Eno into the podcast.
We got him. Everybody check, drink.
Yeah, so, check your bingo card.
If it's later where you are than where we are, go ahead and have a drink for the Brian Eno.
But yeah, so he's probably been on other albums, but I know he was the engineer. He does a lot of prog and that art rock stuff. So,
very good. T, I bet you have quite a few.
I don't have quite a few, but I mean, we can talk about do we want to get the obvious ones out? The Peter Nursery Gabriel. Crime and the Peter Gabriel one. Get those out of the way. How about the Marillion episode?
Well, I got to tell you, listening to this did remind me of Marillion.
Yeah. Well, there's a bit of a, this is one of those tenuous ones, but when we were just started to talk about Foxtrot, and the person who produced Foxtrot was a guy named David Hitchcock. He also produced the very first Marillion single.
Oh.
That had Grendel on it and Market Square Heroes.
So. Grendel.
Well, I have one.
Yeah.
And it's a weird one. And it's the only one I have.
Okay.
The Kinks.
Ah, that makes sense.
I don't
know. Are you going to say what it is?
Yeah. Is it the fact that Village Green is very much about the same sort of subject matter that this album is about?
Right.
The preservation of England.
The theme is remarkably the same and not a theme you would expect to get from rock and roll bands. But
yeah. I guess one other one, the Mellotron makes an appearance on this album quite a bit, actually.
There's another bingo.
Yeah.
How about Dire Straits?
Brett Davies, I think, did the first Dire Straits album, but I don't know.
No, there's a song on this album that talks about Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, so yeah. I thought you were going to say unfortunate balding.
No, and there is a lot of unfortunate balding in this band. But there's a song, of course, on the Dire Straits album we talked about. And I think another person we talked about also, I don't remember who else talked about Romeo and Juliet. But
Springsteen does a Romeo and Juliet.
Shakespeare does. Well, that's it for the connections. Not overly connected for a band that appeared at this time and was in London.
Can I say one more very tenuous one?
Of course.
So when they were, before they started recording this album, Phil Collins started another band called, just as a side project, called Zox and the Radar Boys. And that band had Peter Banks on guitar. Huh. Peter Banks was the original guitarist for Yes, who was replaced by Steve Howe. And we talked about that when we talked about the Tomorrow episode. Yeah. So there's another 10 years.
There we go. And no jokes about that word. All right. So.
Well, so we were talking just real briefly about about Nursery Crime. There's that cool guitar tone.
I don't know how they make that tone.
I know why they call it. What would you say it called?
Wind blast.
Wimhurst.
Cusper. Sounds the same.
No, but the one I was talking about is that really high sounding chimey thing do. And I've seen him do it live, and
Hackett on here?
Yeah.
So that's him messing with the volume knob, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's going,
yeah.
So
pretty good sound.
That is my favorite Genesis song.
I think that's my favorite Genesis song too.
And I love this album, as I mentioned before. I'm not going to bore everybody. You can go back and listen to the podcast, which we encourage, to hear a little bit of the story behind that one. But so Jonathan Anthony, like I said, produced that. Paul Whitehead does the album work, and it's a doozy of an album cover depicting that story from the musical box. That album hits number 39 in the UK charts. But like I said, I'm not going to bore you with a whole lot of stuff about that. Next album up is Foxtrot, which they start writing in the summer of 72. They record in September of that same year at Island Studios. And this album is made up of songs that the band had already started performing live. So they were working out some of the kinks, as well as new material that they would develop through jam sessions, which is kind of the way they started writing at this point. Again, Jonathan Anthony is a producer. These starts off as a producer. These sessions are a little tenser than normal, and the label starts getting worried about the cost and delay. So the band goes on a brief tour of Italy, and when they come back, that's when Dave Hitchcock, who's the guy I talked about with the Marillion thing, takes over as producer. And Paul Whitehead does the artwork for this album as well, but the band all hates this album cover, which I don't know. It's fine, but they all think it looks a little childish.
But didn't they?
That's a weird thing to start getting mad about. Yeah.
But that album has Watcher of the Skies, which is a big fan favorite, and the nearly sidelong tour de force Supper's Ready, composed of 7 parts, longest thing the band ever did.
If you go down to Willow Farm to look for butterflies, flutterbys, gutterflies.
That sounds proggy.
Yeah. So that's 23 minutes long.
But this is what year?
72.
Is everyone conscious of being proggy at this time? Is that set in stone? And so they when people hear this, they immediately think that, or does that name and definition come later?
No, I think this is, I mean, the Yes album, had already come out.
And they've already it's already been described that way, and that label is pretty solid by now.
Yeah. In fact, some labels in the UK, like Harvest, is considered a progressive rock label and stuff. Yeah, so they're starting to bandy that term around. So yeah, that does.
Adam Hart Mother was on Harvest.
That song, Doug, you might be interested in, because it's about the battle of good and evil. That album reaches number 12 on the UK chart. So each subsequent album, they start getting more and more, and a lot of it is due to their touring. And one of the things that happens around the Foxtrot era, and this is something we're talking about because it's important, you can't really take this away from Genesis or not talk about them. Gabriel starts doing things on stage. The first thing he does is in a tour in Italy, he shaves a reverse mohawk into his head.
It's bizarre looking.
And then he starts wearing stage makeup as well. That's the first thing.
And they've become very popular in Italy.
Oh, yeah. Huge. He started telling stories between songs, but he said the only thing he could do during these long instrumental jams was to play the tambourine, and he wanted to have a little bit more of a presence. So he started telling these stories. Then he started doing things like the hair thing, the makeup thing. And that developed into costumes. So he started wearing costumes. And he says he's fine with doing this because he was only too happy to play the game, because they started getting press because of him doing this. Yeah. And the first time he wears, one of the first costumes he wears is he puts on his wife's red dress and he puts on a fox head during the musical box.
Yeah.
And that's what's on the cover.
That's on the cover of Foxtrot, but the song Musical Box is on Nursery Crime. But the first time he does it, he says, is in Dublin.
Didn't he surprise everybody by doing
it? Yeah, nobody was going to do it. And he said, back then, this is a quote from him, back then Ireland wasn't the hippest country in Europe. And there was a palpable sense of shock when he walked out on stage. He thought it was fun. The rest of the band thought they were pretty uncomfortable about it. And then things just got crazier from there. On a couple occasions, he actually attached wires to himself and he flew across the stage. He was singing. This is way before Garth Brooks ever did it.
I bet they needed a lot more wires for Garth Brooks.
Probably. But for the song we just played, Supper's Ready, I think he changes costumes like four times during that song. Going back to what you're talking about, the Genesis Live album, JM, that was a complete surprise to the band. And the reason why the label did it was they wanted product, and they were taking their sweet time between recording of Foxtrot and the recording of what would be Selling by the Pound. And so there was this version of a live concert that was recorded that was going to be broadcast.
The King Biscuit Flower Hour?
Yeah. On American radio. And instead, they packaged it as a bargain LP, and it ended up being their first top 10 album.
Yeah. In England or in the United States?
In England. So that brings us to... It was a long way, guys. Sorry, but that brings us to the album we're talking about tonight, which was recorded in 3 weeks in 1973, produced by John Burns, who'd been the engineer on Foxtrot and the Genesis Live album, actually. The band goes in the studio. They don't have any full songs. They have bits and pieces, including stuff that had been starting during a Foxtrot session, which I think there was an early version of Firth of Fifth that they just ended up scrapping. And so they start jamming and reworking stuff. In hindsight, the band thinks that a lot of the songs, it's funny, the band doesn't particularly care for this album, or the fans do.
Yeah, people weren't a fan of the songs they weren't real fond of the song that Phil Collins actually sings and wrote mm-hmm. with Mike Rutherford, which I think they wrote, well, we'll get to it when we talk, but, and then they weren't real happy with what Steve Hackett was bringing to the table.
But they also thought the long extended jams were just overworked and too busy. Gabriel didn't like that part of it. It's funny, the egos start to pop up a little bit around this time where they're all sort of vying for real estate on the album. But the one of the big influences on the band at this time is the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
John McLaughlin. He's an amazing guitar player, amazing jazz guitar player, played a lot with Miles Davis. And yeah, he's got that kind of prog sounding guitar as well. He's also a big Les Paul player.
But they're classified more as jazz fusion,
yeah,
though.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe more like.
But if you listen to it, I'd be hard pressed to tell the difference, to be honest with you.
Yeah, they sound, you know, they're in kind of that. They're mentioned in the same breath as like Weather Report.
Funny you mentioned Weather Report, because when Phil Collins took lead vocals over the drummer for Weather, one of the drummers for Weather Report ended up, I forget the guy's name.
Oh, Chester Arthur. Yeah, yeah.
It ends up being the drummer for Genesis for a long time, like 15 years or
he's
so.
He's also a lefty.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
oh,
that's kind of weird. You see them, they're both playing.
But yeah, so in this album, you know, like I said, Bits and Pieces, Hackett, it's the first album he doesn't really come with any songs. He says he's just happy to be a guitarist, so he brings these little guitar tricks. But he believes, and a lot of people do, that this was a big step forward for this band. Tony Banks ends up getting some choral things for the Mellotron, so they're able to sound like a choir.
Yeah, and he uses it really, really well.
He's got that synthesizer.
So the synthesizer he plays on this is Arp Pro Soloist, and its claim to fame is it was the first portable synthesizer where you didn't. It came with pre-programmed sounds. So instead of having, if you work with a Moog or, you know, some of the other ones, even other ARP synthesizers, you actually had to dial the sound in. And you had to, you have envelopes and you have filters and you have volume knobs. And so you have to control what the actual sound, the sine wave or the square wave looks like. And this was the first one that just came with sounds embedded in them, and you could just hit different buttons and play them. They were kind of frowned upon. They also were notoriously fickle. I mean, if you had them under the lights or something, you played them live, they could go out of tune pretty easily. They wound up not being manufactured for very long. ARP came out with another one that kind of took off was the ARP.
Was that
Odyssey.
Only for people over 65?
Like the Mellotron.
So oh, you said ARP, not AARP.
AARP. It was it was really popular because you could just have the sound ready to go and you could just press buttons and you wouldn't have to have like 14 keyboards on the stage, each dialed into a different sound. You could just hit a button and it would change the sound of the keyboard. The problem was you couldn't control what these sounds actually were.
Ah. So, well, it's funny. So he's got the only thing it sounds like he could really control was a Hammond organ.
Yeah.
Which he used, he says in interviews, he used 100% of that instrument. But he's got the Mellotron, which are notoriously fickle.
Yeah.
He's got this new synthesizer. It's amazing that he was able to do what he was able to do. And he does a lot with both of those.
He's got, and it's got that Moog sound in it. So that's one of the reasons why it was used so much. And it's got, that's kind of the sound of prog is that Moog. And
well, so we got this album.
Mm-hmm.
What about the cover? This is a compelling cover, and it represents a departure from the previous covers.
Yeah, because they were disappointed, as I said, with the last person. So they end up, Gabriel ends up tapping this London artist named Betty Swanwick.
Swanwick.
Yeah, she'd been used in a lot of London transport ads, and she had a Royal Academy exhibit that he went to, and he's like, ah, this is what we need. So they ask her if they can do something for the album, and because of the time constraints on when the album was going to be released and how long it took her to do something, she said, I can't, but you're welcome to look at my catalog and pick something. So they picked up this existing piece called The Dream, but they asked her...
Yeah, to put in a lawnmower.
And a pitchfork, which she did.
Yeah.
It's funny, there's this great story of them talking about meeting her, like going to talk to her, and she had a parrot. And Tony Banks tells a story about how they were having tea, and she put the table on like a hill, so everything was sliding off the table. And then she had this parrot that was on Peter Gabriel's shoulder, and he's like, he couldn't tell if she was addressing you or the parrot the whole time. She was just this really eccentric old English lady. But the album cover is great.
Yeah, it's a great
and
album.
And it matches the mood of the theme of the album perfectly.
Yeah.
One of the songs is sort of based on that particular image.
Why did they want the addition of the mower and the
Because the song, I Know What I Like.
Yeah. So it was after the song was written, and they needed that to...
They said, better. Can you add that to it so it
I wasn't clear that they had written the song already before they asked for the additions.
Well, so there's sort of mixed things. In the liner notes, it says the song was based on the painting, but they had her add a lawnmower, which seems like the song was written first. Yeah. So I don't know.
It's probably they got going with the painting, and then their song got going, and they added versus it would require lawnmowers and pitchforks.
Me? I'm just a lawnmower. Well, you can tell by the way I walk.
I heard that they put the lawnmower in because of the sounds that Steve Haggett was making on his guitar. They said that kind of...
Is that a guitar making those noises?
That's a guitar making that. Yeah, isn't that
Holy
amazing?
Holy cow, I thought that was a synthesizer.
No, I heard it was the guitar.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, now everybody's excited to hear that. The first song in the theme are very close to one another. Yeah. So why don't we just dive into the first song and you can talk about the theme of the meaning in the first song and then extend that to the theme for the whole album. Up first, we have Dancing with Moonlit Night.
And night is spelled.
That's like not... Don't there's make the mistake I did with Nights in White Satin.
There's lots of little sort of...
In this whole album, it's filled with them.
Can you tell me where my country lies? Said the unicorn to his true love's eyes. It lies with me, cried the queen of maybe. For her merchandise, he traded in his prize. Paper late.
Oh, man, that is a really good beginning.
And the whole song is just like that, ladies and gentlemen.
Doug's pulling your leg.
I am going to play a little section here from later on to give them an idea that this song does move about.
There's a fat old lady outside the saloon, laying out the credit card. She plays for two.
Yeah. And are there some musical breaks?
Yes. I mean, this is kind of the quintessential genesis at this period where they start off with this kind of mellow, nice, I don't know what you call it. I mean, it's almost goosebump inducing with Gabriel's voice over it and everything. And then it slowly progresses to this complicated, this musical jazz fusion, proggy interludes. And then they slide back into that Gabriel stuff as well.
Now, that's one of the things that bothers me about, in general, that bothers me about Prague. And this happens on this album, in particular this song. But it seems like with Prague, there's a lot of times where I'm just listening to something going, man, I really like that. And then all of a sudden it'll change into something that, that's too pretty. We don't want it. We got to make it into something more interesting. And it sometimes is, they're bored with themselves, so they want to just do something that's completely out there. And it happens on this album. There are parts, like, I love how this song starts off. And I love, there's parts in the center of it that I really like. What we just heard, I really like how that, those drums and you got that, it's a really good showcase of the Mellotron in there. It's making those ah sounds. Mm-hmm. Why can't you just take elements of it and make two different songs, or make three different songs? But
well, I don't think you can do that and be Prague.
I was gonna say that as a Prague fan, all the stuff you just mentioned is stuff I love about this song.
I don't disagree with your feeling. The way I describe it on this album is I feel like sometimes the band is competing with the song and they're not in unison.
Yeah.
And what I would say to that is they want it that way. And people like it that way.
Yeah.
So that's why we have this thing called Prague that doesn't pull me in. I didn't have any trouble enjoying this album from the beginning. I think I started listening to it a little more than a year ago. I did have trouble getting a handle on songs.
Right.
And some of that was true in Marillion also, because of these extended
instrumental
parts. And It's been hard for me to embrace or to learn to enjoy the things I used to make fun of so much about this kind of music. And that's the keyboards going all over the place and drums that just are out of control and everybody's virtuoso on display. But I understand, you know, I think there's people who listen to hard bop jazz and going, I always say just play the pretty tune and stop making all these weird noises and running all over the scales. And
yeah.
And so I think what my answer to myself is, you probably just need to keep listening. But it's particular with this band because Gabriel's voice by itself is so compelling that you do want to stretch that out.
But the thing, and I was going to mention this at some point, but I went through a Genesis phase, I guess about 10 or 15 years ago. It was right after I saw that documentary on him, and I thought it was a great documentary. And I remember just loving Foxtrot. I don't think I remember really liking Nursery Crime that much, but when we did it for that other podcast, I remember really liking it. And I remember getting to this album and just going, it's too disjointed. But you know, listening to it again, getting into Gabriel's voice, I really listened to Hackett's guitar playing. And this song, I really remember liking this song. I mean, I'm starting to like this song a lot more because I kind of came at it with fresh ears, I guess.
I think just going back to what I think is what distinguishes this band from other prog bands is I get everything you guys are saying. And the musical breaks are long and complicated and they sort of take you out of the songs. But this band, there's just something about the way this band plays that stuff that doesn't seem as cold as other prog bands.
I'm going to agree with you there. I think that's the saving grace of a lot. I think that's the thing that I'm starting to figure out. Like, this had been Yes.
Yeah, it would be different. It would be different. And that's not, you know, I love Yes, but there's something that always brings me back to Genesis because there's a warmth to the, as odd as that sounds, there's a warmth to their overindulgence that I really, really dig and connect to.
Yeah.
You know,
this, it would be, it's Gabriel's voice. It's so different than, who's the lead?
John Anderson.
Yeah. John Anderson, he sings really well, but he sounds like a synthesizer. It sounds like a computer could make that noise. Yeah. there's a lot of interesting references in this song.
Yeah. So you wanted to talk a little bit about the theme.
Yeah.
So.
This theme for the song, I think, is the theme for the album.
It's essentially about the commercialization of English culture and Gabriel the says
Americanization.
Yeah,
also.
And Gabriel says he wanted to speak to kind of to protect, preserve some of the Englishness that seemed to be at risk. Again, that's why Doug brought up Village Green Preservation Society. It's the same sort of theme. In fact, the extended musical part of this song was originally called Disney for that very reason.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of wordplay in this this album in general, but this song in particular, where he's putting that on display. The fact that when he would perform it live, he would dress like Old Britannia to make the point.
I guess that would be like us dressing up as Uncle Sam.
Kind of, yeah. And the use of the knight. Mm-hmm. In comparison to what he's talking about, contrasts kind of old England with the new. He talks about green shields, which were kind of like green stamps here, I believe. Mm-hmm. Knights of the Green Shield.
A loyalty program.
Yes, yeah. A loyalty program.
So we got our silverware when we lived in New York.
Citizens of Hope and Glory. Hope and Glory is a song that was written in 1901. I didn't know this.
Everybody knows this song.
I didn't know that England didn't have a national anthem. They don't have an official national anthem.
Is that right?
Yeah. And so
it's because they have a royalty. So you don't have to have one if you have one.
But when they did a poll about what should be it, that song, Land of Hope and Glory, out polled God Save the Queen.
Do you know that song, Jim?
I do not know that song.
You're lying. You do that song.
My Country 'Tis of Thee.
You're about to go, oh, yeah.
Wait till you hear it.
Take
over India and broad swaths of Africa.
Pomp and Circumstance. By the way, that was the great Vera Lynn doing that version of that song. Good choice, Doug.
Whatever happened to Vera Lynn?
Very nice. Very nice.
Anyway.
Pomp and Circumstance. Everybody who's gone to a high school graduation has heard that song.
Yeah.
A lot.
But yeah, so that's one of the references.
Shows up in here. And
Wimpy Dreams. The reason that's interesting is because...
It's about the Wimpy Hamburgers.
Which was the first national hamburger food chain in the UK.
Which ruined England.
Yeah.
Well, it's Wimpy's like the one that said, I'll gladly play you Wednesday for a hamburger today or something like that.
Yes.
Was that an English comic strip?
No.
That's Popeye.
Wimpy's... English. I thought Wimpy was a comic strip.
It is. No, Wimpy is Popeye. Wimpy was in Popeye. He was a character in Popeye.
Okay. Yeah. No wonder they look alike.
And then Old Father Thames, which is kind of this river god, British version of Poseidon, I guess.
Yeah. And they have statues of him. And apparently that river had a sewer problem in the 50s. And he may be referring to that. The irony is the river god dies of...
sewage?
He dies of drowning. So I'm sure Gabriel was giggling to himself when he killed a river god by drowning him.
Yeah. I think this is a great opener. I think musically and lyrically, it really sets the theme for this album. What's interesting about this is it was originally supposed to merge directly into the cinema show. And then that was going to follow with Isle of Plenty as a reprise. They ended up breaking it up. I think Phil Collins was the person who was like, if we do that, it's another Supper's Ready. Come on, we got to do something different. So they broke it up. And
yeah,
I think it's a great song. His vocals on it are fantastic.
I love how it starts and I love how it ends.
Steve Hackett's guitar. And there's lots of 12 strings all over this thing.
Yeah. How long is that one?
It's 8 minutes.
Yeah. There's a lot of 8 minute songs on this album, but there's not much longer than that, I don't think.
There's one that's 10. There's two that are 11.
Oh, well, I take that back.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've had to look to see what song I'm on.
Yeah.
Really?
I had to do that too.
And I can understand if I had years with this album, I can see it all clearing up for me. But when I get in the middle of some of these organ solos or what, I don't know where I am anymore.
Right,
I'm not necessarily... This is happening more and more with the records we're doing. There's not a song on here where I say, oh, I want to hear that. But I do think, oh, I'd like to hear that record. You know, I drive around with 5 CDs in my car most of the time, 4 that we're about to do and 1 just because I want to listen to it. Yeah. And so I'm picking between those. And it's interesting when this album pops to the top. It's never because of a song. It's always because of the sound of the whole thing.
Well, that's interesting because that fits the theme of our podcast.
It does. Yeah. And a lot of the records we've done lately are that way.
Yeah.
Chris Christopherson would be an exception. I do want to hear a particular song by him every now and then.
Yeah.
All right. We got a hit, guys.
Quote unquote hit.
This is number 21 in the GB.
Yeah.
That's radio talk for Great Britain. I know what I like in your wardrobe. And then
Mr. Lewis was at the time that he was out on his own. Over the garden wall, two little lovers, cuckoo to you. Keep them moving, they sharp.
I really like that song.
That's my least favorite song on the album.
Is that really true?
Yeah. And it's just because that chorus is unattractive to me.
You know who else it was unattractive to?
I love that chorus.
Gabriel.
Gabriel said he got so bored of singing that after a while. He likes the rest of the song, but that chorus, he just was bored to
tears. Is
that
when he comes out on stage with the lawnmower and he's got that little hat on?
Yeah. This is an interesting, I think Doug, I've grown to like it a little bit. It used to be my least favorite song. It's probably still my least favorite song, but I don't feel the same way about it. It's maybe the least interesting song on the album.
I love the
drums.
There's
the band's doing some interesting things, yeah. But the song itself.
And the playing on it is fantastic. The drumming and got Mike Rutherford. He's actually in the pocket.
Well, the bass is great on this, and you can really hear it during that chorus. That to me is the most interesting part of the chorus is when Rutherford's bass kicks in. So this was based on a riff by Steve Hackett that he was just playing around during the Foxtrot sessions, and he plugged it in through Tony Banks Leslie cabinet and started playing it, and then Phil Collins started jamming with it. The rest of the band didn't care much about it, but Collins and Hackett kept playing it over and over and over again. Finally said, okay, let's do something with this. The reason they didn't like it, and this is a head scratcher to me, is they said it sounded too much like the Beatles. And I wish I could understand where that's coming from, because I don't get the Beatles-esque part of this.
Especially when it gets down to that, the organ part that, where they kind of do that break after the chorus. That doesn't sound anything at all like the Beatles.
It's not You're No Good, where once who was it that said the guitar solo said the guy heard it and he says, is this the Beatles?
Oh yeah.
Some comedian said that was dating her at the time or something. And once you hear that, you can't unhear it. You immediately, that song sounds like a Beatles.
It sounds like Harrison.
Before I heard that line, it didn't sound like the Beatles. After I heard that line, I still don't hear it.
Yeah.
So what is this about, Tony?
Well, it's about a guy who's just content with being a groundskeeper, and he's got all these people trying to tell him he needs to better himself, and he just doesn't care about that. He's very content in being who he is. It's supposedly loosely based on one of their roadies who was a guy who couldn't keep a job. I think the guy unfortunately ended up dying
of a heroin overdose.
Yeah. But that's who they say it's loosely based on. Here's what's kind of interesting, and I never really thought about this. This song is the whole album is, but this song in particular, the allusions are very British. I remember hearing this song on American radio. I heard this song when I was a kid on the radio. Not that often, but I did. And I can't imagine being like a teenager listening to it and trying to understand what the references are. It opens up
without the internet.
Yeah. It opens up with the line. There's always been Ethel. Now to us, that's a name
or gasoline.
But what it is it's an old English term for the aristocracy.
Huh?
So when he says this is Jacob talking, saying there's always been these people and I'm perfectly content being a workhorse for them, you know.
Is Mr. Lewis significant?
I don't know.
Yeah, there's looking at the lyrics on this, I couldn't understand what was going on. I think because he lost me at Ethel. But what's the in your wardrobe part?
I don't know. It's like an allusion maybe to C.S. Lewis.
That's what I heard on the show, but I don't see it.
I don't either. And Tony Banks said that he thinks that little bit of it is one reason it kept it from going higher, because people are like, what the heck does wardrobe have to do with anything?
I know what I like in your wardrobe, then it goes through the wardrobe.
I think it might have something to do with, I don't know, maybe somebody looking at somebody dressing better or something. I don't know.
Somebody said that you get inside the wardrobe to smoke a doobie and come out.
That's
better.
All BS. I don't believe in any of that. Yeah, there's not any pot allusions to this song. I mean, the band would have talked about that.
Most of the time in rock and roll, if people don't know what you're talking about, they'll decide it's about...
That's true.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
There's a reference to the Garden Wall, which is that band that Tony Banks and Peter Gabriel were in at Charterhouse. I find it interesting. There's a line where he says something about you've got a future in the fire escape. Was it a future in the fire escape trade? That always to me always seemed like the guy's like, hey, you know, you come like robbery, like armed robbery or something. You go up the fire escape, you steal stuff, and you come back down. I have no idea what that
means. This is the one that required adaptations of the cover.
Yeah. This is the one the cover's based on, and they had they added the lawnmower and the.
I guess the guy they're singing to is the guy lying on the bench here.
Right. Yeah. That's
looking and that I guess Jacob. He's dreaming.
Yeah.
Looking through there.
Supposedly what that is a bunch of people standing there telling him how to better his life is what the cover is. That's what people have said. Okay. I don't know. Here's a really funny story about this. So this gets enough airplay and it's a big enough hit to where it's going to be on Top of the Pops. the band refuses to go on Top of the Pops.
Really?
So what happens is the song is played and it's acted out by a performance dance group.
And it's horrible.
It is. It's horrible. It's horrible.
Is this the one that where Gabriel, when before he sings a song, he makes a little speech about being a cosmic lawnmower in live performance?
Oh, in the live performance when he talks about, it's been a while since I've watched. There's a great concert footage of them at Shepperton Studios where he gives a speech, and it's been a while since I've watched it. So he may do that there.
So, and it, that lawnmower sound was made by, we were talking about this earlier. That's,
made with a guitar.
It's made with a guitar.
It's amazing to me because I would have sworn that was a keyboard making it.
Yeah, I think it's just he's got echo all over the place and maybe going through the Leslie cabinet. I don't know how he's making that sound, but it's amazing.
Well, you can do that if you want to play guitar when your mom has told you to go mow the yard. You just make those noises. That's probably how he learned to do it. Yep. Next, we have, I've been worried about saying this wrong since we first started talking about this. Firth. A fifth?
Yep, that's right. Firth of Fifth.
Yep.
Wow, that's pretty piano playing.
he could never
do it on
do
stage.
It live.
Yeah.
Who's he?
Tony Banks.
Tony Banks. And one of the reasons was he didn't use a proper piano.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He would. He just said he couldn't get it anything. He could not reproduce it on. I think he was using a pianette, which is like a early electric piano that's supposed to make it sound like a piano. He said it sounded like
he can't do that's they probably don't have 66 keys. He probably couldn't do that heavy thing at the bottom.
Yeah.
So this song was three different songs that Tony Banks had around. They did, like I mentioned, they tried to do a bit of it for Foxtrot and it didn't work. He says, well, I love this description. I think it's perfect. He goes, yeah, you know, I was hoping they'd be three different songs, but they were all relegated to the Banks ghetto. The band wanted me to just put them all together. So he tried to make it work. And it's Firth of Fifth because there's a bit of a...
this is another British thing, isn't it?
Well, there's an aquatic theme to it. And a firth is a Scottish name for a river estuary. And there's actually the River Forth in Scotland. So there's a Firth of Forth. And so this is a pun on that Firth of Fifth. Huh. But yeah.
And it's really, really strange time signatures that he's playing. It's like that opening piece that we just heard. It's just bizarre time signatures.
Okay, there's a part without vocals. Well, and we have a little flute there.
That's
with that Jethro Tull.
That's no, it's Gabriel playing the melody.
I couldn't
part
hear him. I couldn't hear him spitting into the flute, so I'm assuming it wasn't Tull. that little clip right there, that's Prague. If any of y'all don't know what Prague is, or you want to tell your mom, just give her that clip right there. I'm still looking for lyrics. I'm sorry,
you're
folks.
You're going to have a hard time because there's not a lot of lyrics.
He rides majestic past homes of men who care not or gaze with joy.
This song might be a good sample of what this album is.
Yeah.
Musically.
Why is that?
Because it's got the... meandering.
Well, it's got all the elements in one song, it seems to me.
With the exception, I don't think these are the strongest lyrics on the album. Tony Banks wrote them, and even that little clip you played,
he
walks
he
majestic
like
by the homes of men. It's just goofy sounding.
Well, I think he even doesn't like them.
I think you're right about that.
I think he said that these are the worst lyrics he ever wrote, and he didn't expect them to actually make it.
Well, when I said I think it's a good sample... I just meant musically.
Okay.
Because Gabriel's lyrics are very different than these.
Well, so, you get to hear just Phil Collins' drumming.
It's great on this.
It's incredible on this.
The one thing we didn't talk about, and Doug, you're going to unfortunately have to play another bit of the song, which is the very...
It'll be a record.
The very end part, which has Steve Hackett's guitar solo on it. We've got to play that because it is the... best best guitar solo ever on a Genesis.
I've heard everybody say it's the best of Genesis.
Yeah, it's his ever. Favorite. That's incredible.
It's very Gilmore-esque.
It is.
And very tunefulness.
Fripp-esque, in my opinion.
Well, you know why it's Fripp-esque.
Sounds like he's using a bow.
Yeah.
You know why it's Fripp-esque?
Huh.
Is because, so that was originally, the flute part we heard, that's the flute part done through the guitar, with the guitar, and he just started goofing around playing it electric, and Tony Banks is like, you know what, I'm going to put these big banks of Mellotron on it, like King Crimson, as a joke, and then as they're playing it, he's like, that sounds pretty damn good, let's put that on the song, so that's why it's very King Crimson-esque. Huh. Hackett, when he's talking about it, saying he was going for this kind of Middle Eastern, trying to sound like a sitar, and he says the reason why it sounds like, he admits this, he's like, everybody thinks I've got great sustain on that solo. He goes, I was just in close proximity to the amp, so I could fade in and out, so it sounds like that. But trust me, I did not have great sustain to that solo. It's just a bunch of studio trickery. But it's a fantastic solo.
Well, this is, they play this song live a lot. I mean, not the piano intro, but one of the reasons why they do it is because the guitar solo is so incredible.
Are there any more songs? I think we have to flip this sucker over.
No, we got one.
Oh, that's right. I remember the guy saying that this is where it should have ended.
I think be nice to Phil.
Well, I don't know who the guy was. It was just somebody, a critic I was reading.
Tony Banks feels the same way, I think.
All right. So the next song is More Fool Me. And this is a Phil Collins song?
This is Phil Collins, the second time he sings lead on a Genesis song, yeah.
He'll get more chances later.
He does.
A very important life lesson is taught there.
Which is?
Don't sing on albums where Peter Gabriel sings.
Well, he's perfectly serviceable as singing with Gabriel. They sound great.
He's a fantastic backup singer. Yeah. And, I've always had this struggle. Why do these guys sound so much alike, but I like one and not the other?
Yeah.
This album helped me sort that out a little bit.
He just doesn't have the resonance, for one thing. And he's singing too high. He shouldn't be singing.
Yeah, he's got that weird falsetto thing. And this song was composed on the stairs of the studio.
Yeah.
And the only reason it's on here is the producer said, you need something to break up the heaviness of this album.
Yeah.
That does it.
Yeah,
that is.
It sounds like Against
a Feather.
That song.
It does sound like. I hadn't thought about that. It does sound like his future sort of ballady stuff.
Yeah.
The other song he sings on Nursery Crime for Absent Friends is actually a really good song. So I don't know. It's a weird choice.
Yeah.
I thought about the fact if you're singing backup to someone all the time, it's inevitably your phrasing and a lot is going to imitate theirs. And I watch concert films. He sings back up more than anyone else in this band, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That's why it's so weird that they thought they had to look so far and wide to find a replacement
what that speaks volumes to is they didn't want to lose him as a drummer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because if you listen to the song we just played before this,
he's amazing.
Firth of Fifth, he's incredible on that song.
Well, they should have listened to our band podcast and they'd know they don't have to lose their drummer.
True. Yeah. That's true. This is the only song that Tony Banks is not on.
Is that right?
Yeah, on the album. And he hates the song, which may be why he hates it.
Yeah.
We got to flip this sucker over.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to some what did he call it? Heaviness?
Yeah.
This song is not heavy.
The subject matter is very heavy. No. The Battle of Epping Forest. That sounds like I'm trying not to curse, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So why do you think the subject matter is heavy on this song?
Isn't this about gang fight?
That's what I thought it was, about gang violence.
It's about a gang warfare, but Gabriel encompasses all these goofy characters, and he's like doing Monty Python voices, and there's all this funny wordplay. This song's hilarious. Absolutely hilarious, I think.
I guess young people killing each other is funny.
That's not what the song is about. Just look at the lyrics.
This is one of those songs where there's parts of it I really like. That part we just heard, I love how it begins. I think that's really cool with Gabriel's voice and that kind of marching band kind of center, mm-hmm. minstrel sort of thing. That synthesizer solo, and I guess that's that Art Pro soloist, presetting. It just grates on me. I get really, really tired of just hearing that sound, and that's a pretty proggy synthesizer sound that drives me nuts.
The band had a real issue with the song because they loved the music, and then Gabriel comes back and he's as Phil Collins says, he sucked all the air out of the song by having all these words on top of it, and he said that he'd sucked up all the space. I don't
agree with that.
I like this song a lot. It is wordy, and Gabriel even admits, he goes, yeah, I didn't edit it much, but he spent so much time building the characters and the scenes, he didn't want to edit it, but he said it probably could have used a little bit of that. If you're listening to it and looking at the lyrics, it's tough. It's like bam, 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 bam. They are firing the words off to you.
Yeah.
And there's many references not suited for the American.
Like what? Crumpets,
but they're talking about a lot of things I don't think Americans would know.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. One of the funny things, Rolling Stone, when they're reviewing this album, they pointed out this song in particular, and the quote in it is they quote the line, "I do my double show quick," said Nick the Prick, fresh out of the Nick. And then what they say is that carries rhyming into the realm of the silly. And like I said earlier, they're missing the point. This song is supposed to be silly.
It's a playful song.
It is a playful song.
And it's like Madman Bummers, Drummers, and Indians in the Summer.
Yeah.
It's no one's supposed to sit down and take all that stuff real seriously.
It's not We Didn't Start the Fire.
This is a fun song.
I think so.
And I'm glad they didn't cut the lyrics. I think
the lyrics are the most, his singing and the lyrics, I think, are the very most interesting.
I can't imagine trying to sing this thing live.
Except for the beginning, except for that.
I would need words.
Yeah, and you know how he dressed as what he called, so one of his characters in this is the Reverend, which is really, that bit's really funny, where he talks about being the Reverend. But the character he dressed as he's singing this dressed as that. He's got a pantyhose over his face with the eyes cut out and the mouth cut out. I can't imagine how uncomfortable that would be. And he's like wearing a tuxedo.
Robbing a bank?
I don't know, but it's, the Reverend ends up, what does he say? He's got a different boss, same name, different boss.
Here's something I want to say this about Peter Gabriel. He does all these flamboyant things on stage, especially back in Genesis day. But do you ever hear him interviewed? Mm-hmm. He is like the most low-key, like unexcitable.
He's a couple of things about that. He's low-key. He's funny as hell.
He is funny.
And he's very generous in every interview I've ever heard him talk about. He just seems very like...
He loves the musicians that he plays with.
Including this band. Yeah. He talks very, very well about all the people in this band. Yeah. It's unlike some of the other... Like Tony Banks seems like a sourpuss in these interviews.
Yeah.
Whereas Gabriel is very, very generous about this stuff. I love this song a lot. I've grown to love it even more listening to it this time because I was paying attention to it in a way I hadn't before and really got the sense of humor. And that's the thing people don't think about with Genesis is there's a lot of humor in their songs. One of the previous podcasts, we talked about Harold the Barrel, which is a song about a guy contemplating jumping off of a building. But that song's hilarious. Yeah. It's a subject matter is not that funny, but the song is really funny, you know?
And there was no one left alive. It must have been a draw.
Go ahead and hit you.
All right. We got us a couple of more numbers here.
We got instrumental.
Yeah.
We got After the Ordeal. Is this referring to the song we just heard?
I think so.
This is the instrumental.
Uh-huh.
And who's the superstar on this one so we can listen for it?
Gotta be Hackett.
Steve Hackett. It's Steve Hackett and Rutherford, and Tony Banks plays piano, I think.
That wasn't a hit.
It's another song Tony Banks hates. In fact, he says this is the one song he would have not put on the album.
I heard there was some animosity about it from everybody on this. This is kind of to appease Hackett. He was kind of like, if you don't put this on, I'm going to.
He did. Yeah, he said he threatened to quit the band.
Yeah. He
must have been his Harrison moment.
I like it. It you know, it's odd. Talking what Doug was saying earlier, I thought this was part of the first time I was hearing it. I thought it was the start or the end of the Battle of Effing Forest. But
I think it's supposed to be, you know, it is it. After the ordeal. Yeah, so I think it's supposed to flow into that.
But I like it. It was just Hackett and Rutherford just playing around from what I understand.
Yep. And the electric bit on the end, I think, is Rutherford playing that.
I think that's Rutherford, yeah.
Because Hackett said he tried to do an electric guitar and nobody could get it to work. And then when he heard what Tony Banks was doing on the piano, he picked up a classical with nylon strings and just started playing it. And it gelled at that point for everybody but Tony Banks, I guess.
Yeah.
We have the cinema show next, number 7.
Scurries up the stair with head held high and floral tie, a weekend millionaire. I will make my bed with her tonight. He cries, can he fail? Armed with his juggling surprise.
Yeah, this is my favorite song on the album.
It's the best song on the album, one of the top 3-4 best songs this band ever did.
Yeah, it gets into that weird keyboard miasma, but there's the lyrics are great on it. I love that guitar sound, and I've saw a video of them doing it. That's Tony Banks, Steve Hackett, and Mike Rutherford all playing 12 strings.
Yeah. That's the thing they do.
Yeah,
you know.
And it's just beautiful.
Rutherford talks about in an interview tuning his 12 string differently for the song. I guess they're tuned. Typically, they're tuned in tandem, and he tuned them
in like fifths,
in harmony with each other.
Huh.
He has no idea how he did it because he can't replicate it.
Really?
He can't replicate it. So, he tuned it, and this is based on "The Wasteland" by T.S. Eliot.
Mm-hmm. I read that too, but it's just beautiful. And it I love how it starts and I love how it ends. It's just, this is the prettiest thing I think they've ever done.
When the Tiresias?
Tiresias.
Tiresias, it's a character that experienced being a man and a woman.
Yeah, supposedly there's varying stories, but the one I heard that I think is the neatest is he struck a pair of copulating snakes. And as punishment, he was turned into a woman for 7 years. And then in order to be turned back into a man, he went back and struck another pair of copulating snakes and turned into a man. So he experienced what it was like to be a man and a woman. And he was a seer. And so the gods were arguing about who experiences more pleasure during sex. Uh-huh. And Zeus said women, and Hera said no, men. And so they asked him to come up, and he agreed that it was women, which is the reason why in this line, when he says the thing about, was it, there's like a man, like a man, like the sea I raised, like a woman with the earth I gave, but there's always more earth than sea. And that's his point, is that women, there's more, always more earth. And that's what that's an allusion to.
Okay.
Cool. So
very interesting. Even though traditionally the sky was the man in most religious systems, Mother Earth and Sky Father. Huh. And the sky would rain upon the earth, and there you go. There you got your increase.
You got your...
This was actually written lyrically by Banks and Rutherford. Yeah. The only real contribution Gabriel had was he thought it was important to talk about Romeo and Juliet. And I love that lyric we listened to about Romeo, where he says...
he's sitting in his flat.
He's wearing his flowered tie, a weekend millionaire. And then he says a thing about... what's the thing about the chocolate surprise? I love that line. That, yeah, will he fail armed with his chocolate surprise? That's almost like a jellyfish lyric. Armed with a chocolate surprise.
That is like a jellyfish.
Anyway, it's such a brilliant song. Yeah. Unbelievably brilliant. It's 11 minutes long. I don't think it feels like it.
Who plays the oboe?
He, I think
that's Gabriel.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Such a talented young boy. Yeah. It's an interesting song, and I like it a lot.
Yeah. It's a very interesting song. It's one of the, like I said, I think it's the prettiest thing they've ever done. It's
an interesting theme.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out who likes the love better.
Everybody plays incredibly on this as well.
Hackett is not on it much. He does these
splashes.
Right, but the ending extended part was mainly Collins, Rutherford, and Banks. And I think Hackett was a little upset that he was excluded from it.
Huh. And here's a pop quiz for our host and producer. What other song has the word dabs in it?
Don't know.
Johnny sleeps and sheets, dabs with sweat, and watches them dream on and dream on. Those romantic young boys, all they ever want to do is fight.
One of my favorite songs. I should know.
It's a connection, and that guy acted like a woman too. All right, we're down to our last song, Isles of Plenty. This is dedicated to Costco,
and it's aisle spelled like a grocery store.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
Easy love, there's the safe way home. Thankful for her fine fair discount. Tess cooperates. Still alone in oh hello. See the deadly nightshade grow.
Does that sound like when Peter Gabriel's by himself in the future?
A little bit. I could see that.
There's a big marked difference between, I mean, just right there, I just thought about this, having Gabriel sing in a falsetto and listening to Colin sing in a falsetto. Yeah, I mean, it's like different. Night, shade, and day.
I'm just going to say again, ladies and gentlemen, if you are asked to sing on a record and Gabriel's on that record, you just go ahead and say no thank you.
Yeah. So there's a couple of allusions to grocery stores in the lyrics on this song.
Yeah.
If you could tell, the tune circles back to the first song on the album, Dancing in the Moonlit Night. And then there's Safeway Home, Fine Fair Discount, Tess cooperates. Tesco is also a UK store. Huh. And then on the, we didn't get to it, but as it fades out, Collins and Gabriel start singing food prices and food items in the round. They start just singing it as the song fades out.
Yeah.
So again, it's kind of wrapping up that commercialization, mainly about the fact that these big stores were coming in to being really popular in the city centers in the UK at this time.
Wiping out the mom and pops.
Wiping out the mom and pops.
That happens every generation.
And this is the one where Mike Rutherford, I think, plays the cello on that. You can hear that little...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So at first I thought it was a Mellotron. I go, wait, that's
a cello?
That's a cello.
I thought it was a Mellotron too.
Well, there is Mellotron, but then there's sort of scraping on the strings of a cello.
Great way to end the album.
It is.
Wraps things up with a nice, pretty bow.
I want to say one thing about this song. It's kind of negative and kind of positive. I love this melody. Mm-hmm. I love this production. And I wish it was about something else.
This could be
something. A haunting and...
Yeah.
It could be in the league with Green Sleeves or something like that as far as a great love song. Mm-hmm. Or,
yeah.
It would be really good if someone died and someone's left longing.
Yeah.
It'd be brilliant.
Hans Christian Andersen type thing. You know, Little Mermaid.
Get me a sad Irish story and put it to that tune. Yeah. But I guess he was really upset about
Tesco.
Costco.
Tesco.
Yeah. Wait. I wonder how he'd feel now with Costco and Walmart.
Yeah.
He'd have to write the song again. Yeah. Saving all those people all that money. Anyway.
But
efficiency saves poor people money. Just saying. Everybody loves to. Who's your buddy that was always attacking Walmart and his stupid songs?
We'll
cut this, by the way.
Jason Bales, yeah.
Everybody loves to attack Walmart.
He's self-service. Do you know what that is? What a terrible, terrible song.
Cut that. Well, Tony.
Yeah, Doug.
Is this the best Genesis album?
Okay, so there's that conflict between best and favorite.
That's why I asked you. I know which one's your favorite.
I don't know. No.
Which one's the best?
Maybe this is it, now that I think about it. I guess, like I said, this is the best distillation of what they were doing at the time. So, yeah, I guess so. It doesn't have... I think overall, it's probably their best album. Yeah.
Jonathan Jamro, if you were able to get your scissors out and go to A Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, could you make that album better than this one?
I don't think I could.
Okay.
That's my favorite album by them, and I mainly because of the opening track.
Well, it's got moments on it that blow things on this album away.
Yeah.
Carpet Crawlers, the Lamia, you know, all of that, Fly on the Windshield, all of that stuff is, that stuff's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing music.
The playing on it is incredible. I mean, the playing on this is really incredible. To me, they just hit their stride playing on that album. Mm-hmm. They sound much more like this one sounds a little bit to me like they still haven't coalesced, even though this is their fifth album. By the time they were on Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, they're just hitting on all.
Well, the songs are much punchier. They're shorter songs. You know, and they were able to noodly doodly in their little instrumental breaks that were more weird than anything else. So maybe that's why it feels that way.
I like weird.
Is it even better than Abacab?
I kind of like that album. You know,
look, there's a lot of that late era Genesis stuff Duke. I like. I mean, even later, I like the song "Land of Confusion" a lot. I actually like that song. Yeah,
I don't really see. That's where they started losing me after was that song "Man on the Corner." I thought that was a great song.
I don't own any of that stuff, but I don't if it comes on the radio, I'm not turning it off.
Yeah, yeah, classic rewind.
Invisible Touch stinks.
Yeah,
Illegal Alien stinks.
Yeah. So the thing that's interesting is what happens to this band after, because this is the first one where Steve Hackett's not real fond of what his contributions on it.
Although, he loves the album though.
He loves the album. In fact, doesn't he play this album in its entirety live now?
He does. He thinks this is their best album.
Well, his playing on this is
stellar.
Is remarkable, and it's fresh and it's new. I mean, you know, it's stuff. Guitars still weren't sounding like that.
Still don't know what that tone is. It's so it's just incredible. I can't believe I didn't mention this when we were talking about Dancing in the Moonlight. When he says "Paper Late," that ends up being a Genesis song later. I mean, another Genesis song.
It's also the thing they holler out when they're doing sound checks.
So this album hits number 3 on the UK charts, it's the first Genesis album to chart in the States. It hits number 70 in the States.
Huh.
they do a promotional tour in Paris, and Gabriel starts wearing the old Henry mask for when he does the musical box, and it is, I will post the video on the website.
It's bizarre.
I think it's great. I think it's what it makes me love this band even more every time I watch that. It's just so,
it weirds me out.
I love it.
Anyway, thank you, Tony, for exposing us to Prague. Not once, but at least twice. We've had three times. We've had some Rush, we've had some Marillion, and we've had some Genesis.
Yeah.
Is there an American Prague band you're going to expose us to at some point?
Kansas.
I would love to play a Kansas album. You guys wouldn't do it justice, so I won't do that.
No, we can do it.
I had Point of No Return and Monolith.
There's a modern, sort of a neo-prog band, American band I would play called Echelon, that is amazing. But I don't know if I'll ever bring them up.
I have this CD here. It has a picture of a bunch of records that come after this one. Can you tell us what happens to this band?
Well, they go in the studio and to work on their what a lot of people think is their magnum opus, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, the double album we've been talking about off and on tonight. At the time, Gabriel, two things happened that kind of put some pressure on him. He is tapped by William Friedkin, the director of The Exorcist, to work on a movie script, because on that Genesis Live album, there was a short story on the back of it that Willem Friedkin liked, and so he thought it'd be interesting. So Gabriel asked the band, because he's writing most of the lyrics for The Lamb, he asked them to can we put a pause in this while I go do that? They don't like that idea, because as he says, tongue firmly planted in cheek, back then they didn't appreciate the guys doing extracurricular stuff like they do now.
Yeah.
And then he had his first kid, and his first kid was born ill. So ill that the parents couldn't even hold the baby for a while. And the band was not very welcoming to the idea that he needed to be away to deal with his kid. Yeah. So after The Lamb Lies Down is finished, I think maybe 5 dates into the tour, he tells the band he's done and he leaves. He leaves at the end of that tour. They continue with Phil Collins as lead singer, do a couple of albums with them as a four-piece. And then Steve Hackett leaves, and they record the aptly titled Then There Were Three. they go their separate ways. Genesis becomes significantly more commercially successful once Gabriel leaves, as does Peter Gabriel. We talked about all of his stuff in our Peter Gabriel episode. You can go back and listen to that. That's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey says.
Well, at this time, ladies and gentlemen, we give two ratings. We give one rating pretending like we're critics, and we give another rating based strictly on how much we like it without regard to anything but our own preferences. And I'm going to start with our humble producer, Jonathan J. M. Rowe. What do you got there?
All right. Thank you, Doug. As a critic, I'm going to give my critic rating first. It's a 4-0, and it's, for what it is incredible. It's a prog album. It's one of the best prog albums, I think, that's probably out there. It's a great example of it. The playing is expert, and it's a little bit more than just that it's expert. It also, as Tony was saying, there's a little bit of feeling. It's not cold. The playing is not cold on this. It's not like listening to Tales of a Topographic Ocean or some of those, even stuff by King Crimson. I mean, there's just stuff here that is just very, very warm sounding, and just the overall. So here's, I'm going to say something to give my personal rating. There are works of art, movies, and musical pieces that leave me scrambled. When I'm thinking about movies, it's like Kubrick movies. When I'm thinking about art, it's like Rothko paintings or something. When I'm thinking about music, I think of some stuff by Miles Davis or John Coltrane, where my brain, and even King Crimson does it. Some of the guitar playing that Robert Fripp does, just, it leaves my brain scrambled, and that in a good way. That means that I can tell that my brain is exercising. I can't label the feeling that I'm having, but there is emotion there. There were parts on this album where that was happening. And it was like with Steve Hackett's guitar playing, just some of the beginning of Firth of Fifth, the piano part on that was just blowing me away. I could just feel like there was, again, there was emotion there. I wish it could sustain that, because it does. There are parts that are just absolutely beautiful and haunting. And so it's kind of like I'm straddling. I want to be sort of scrambled, but I also just want to feel some nice warm fuzzies. And that does happen with, there are some sad parts to this, or some happy parts in this, or some funny parts in this. And the more I listen to it, the more I like this album, but the further I get away from that scrambling. So I'm going to give it a 3.8 as a personal rating.
Oh, thanks. Thank you for that brief record. I'm going to be really quick. My problem with this album, as I said, is I think sometimes the musicians are competing with the songs. But I think what Jonathan's talking about is this is a cerebral album. And it requires you to think hard about lyrics, and it requires your brain to listen to what's going on with all these different instruments. And it's intriguing. It scratches your brain while you're listening to it, like a good science fiction book does. So I appreciate that, and I agree with Jonathan on that part. I'm going to give a rating for my rating before I give my ratings. I'm going to give this rating of mine a 2. And I say that because I don't think anybody should take me very seriously on this rating. It's a little bit like what we had with Sugar Ross. Is I feel like I'm too far away from what I know to be too accurate. I'm going to give this critics rating. I think it's above a 4.5 and below 5, maybe 4.7 or 4.8. There's innovative things happening here that we can't tell anymore because everybody's adopted similar things. The singing is fantastic. The instruments are impressive, and the songwriting's impressive. My personal rating, I'm going to give it a 4.2. I will listen to it again, but it's not going to ever get to heavy rotation unless something profound happens to my brain. It's just outside of my area of interest, but that may change. I'll catch myself listening to stuff I never used to listen to because of this podcast. Now we'll go to the picker of the thing itself. Well, one other thing about ratings, Rolling Stone gave this a
2
when it came out.
Idiots.
I just, you know why I brought that up?
Why?
Because I love it pointing out how wrong they are.
Yeah.
Over time, they almost always seem to get it wrong.
Well, you know, when this album came out, Rolling Stone was too hip to ever give anything that was even remotely prog outside of maybe King Crimson a decent rating.
But they were really good at getting things wrong their entire career. And I'd like to tell Rolling Stone, thank you for that. T?
Yeah.
How about some ratings?
So I'm just the opposite of you guys, and I don't know why that is. I can listen to prog and I get emotion from it, and I struggle with some of the stuff you guys recommend, like some of the like British based white blues stuff. I find it difficult to connect with that stuff, but this stuff for some reason I can connect to emotionally. So I'm kind of just the opposite of you. Although I've gotten a little better. Again, the podcast helps. I'm going to give my critics rating. I think this is this band firing on all cylinders. I think this is the most representative album of their work. It's concise. It's accessible compared to some of their other stuff. The stories aren't weird. They're based in sort of, again, accessible stuff. So I'm going to say it's a 4.8. Personally, I have grown to appreciate this album even more than I did listening to it for the podcast. Really, really started to... Battle of Loving Forest was always something I just sort of liked, and I love that song now. I just think it's everything about it I really, really like. So I'm going to give it a 4.6. There's a couple of things that just, you know, the Phil Collins song's a little eh. I don't skip it personally, but it's a little eh. There's a couple of other things, but so that's my rating.
All right. Thank you for that, Tony. And thank you, dear listener, for letting us fill your airwaves with yet another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. If you know anyone who likes the long player format and appreciates reviews of those albums, please let them know about this podcast. We're available on most podcasting platforms. And while you're up on one of those podcasting platforms, please leave us a review, leave us some stars. We're always anxious for some feedback. You can also visit our increasingly popular Facebook group page if you're so inclined. There you can find links to past episodes and current episodes.
And tell us your opinion.
And also, if you're old school like me, you can drop us an email at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our website, www.tappingvinyl.com. You'll find links to all our past episodes, pictures, videos about things we've mentioned in these episodes. You can also contact us there. Next week, we're going to be looking at an album. It's a return to one of our favorite artists, Van Morrison, his 1986 album, No Guru, No Method, No Teacher. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe, reminding you, it's scrambled eggs.
What is he... spraying the ducks? He just got up and, ladies and gentlemen, if in case this isn't cut out, Doug just got up and ran to spray his ducks with a hose.
Like spraying ducks.